You're listening to the Australian Hunting and Beyond podcast with Matt, where we talk about hunting, shooting, fishing, camping, and everything else that the great outdoors has to offer. Let's get into it.
All right, long time coming, this one. Was scheduled for a few weeks back now, but I'm lucky enough to have Ian Hurley joining us from the Hunters Campfire podcast, one of the trio. Mate, how are you? I do apologise because it was me delaying it. It was a pretty rough January for some illness on my side, but what's going on with you?
You might be well known these days for a couple of things, and one of them is probably a weak gut. So I wasn't surprised to hear you had bugs from the kids, but we all get them. It's the way it goes. I'm suffering from one now, to be fair.
Man, it was – look, I don't even know. I don't know what it is. I was talking to someone about this the other day. I really feel like, as a teacher, man, parents send their kids to school sick all the time. And I've got no issue with it. I get it. You got to work and like you only have so many days off sick and things like that. I've never had an issue with it. And I had a cracking immune system. And then COVID hit.
Oh.
And the lockdowns. And I really feel as soon as that hit, I just wasn't exposed to all the crap. And then it just caught up to me. And ever since that, and then having toddlers at daycare, it's like my immune system's just gone to rubbish. And I just catch absolutely everything.
Yeah.
And it's crazy. I've never taken so many sick days off in my life.
Yeah, it's rough, eh? My boy has just turned six, so I think he's a year or so in front of yours. How old are your twins?
My oldest is 3.5.
All right. So we went through COVID at daycare.
Yeah. Okay.
Right. So COVID happened, we all locked up. And then when we were allowed to, you know, start going back into the world, my boy was in daycare, and I shit you not, I've never been as sick ever in my life until I had a child that went to daycare, and I was like, oh yeah, come on, right? How bad can it be? I'm pretty sure it was the first or second day my child was there, I got a call from the carers, your son's got hand, foot, and mouth.
Oh,
I said, well, I've never heard of this thing. Start Googling it. What's going on with this? I said, how do you know? He looks fine. He's acting fine. He's got a blister on his foot. And I said, okay, righto. Well, send him home then. I guess we've got to check this out. And man, this thing the size of a pinprick, right? Tiniest little spot. I don't even know that that's what it is. But anyway, he got over it. Meanwhile, my face is covered in blisters and like anywhere there's hair on your face, eyebrows, hairline, beard, I was just a mess of scabby disgustingness, and my wife got it, and she was sick, and I was sick. It turned and morphed into something else that he brought home. I got nearly pneumonia. Anyway, it was welcome to the podcast. This is about daddy daycare. What a way to start. It's terrible. It's terrible stuff.
It's a big part of it now because, you know, the amount of money hunting trips I've had to like just pull the pin on because the wife's got sick or the kids are sick and then daycare, it's so different having kids than prior to kids, just being able to do what you want when you want. And now it's just that extra element. And I love it, don't get me wrong, but it definitely does put an extra strain on it. So it's it's pretty insane. But so we pushed it off. But, man, I'm good now, touch wood. It's been sort of another probably 3 weeks now after we were scheduled and had to cancel. And I'm back to normal, have not got sick. None of the kids have got sick at daycare. It's all going good. So I'm a little nervous coming into the rut because they're probably holding it till then.
Kind of want to get it again now so that you come right for then. I don't know. I reckon it comes around in sort of 6 month spates anyway. You take it as it comes. I've been pretty blessed really with hunting trips. I don't guide, so chuck that out there, but I organize a lot of trips. And when I was doing a lot of work with the ADA, and the local branch where I was, I'd organise trips to New Zealand and we'd take six people and get choppers and, you know, go in the Alps and just go and have a whale of a time. And probably in 10 years of doing this stuff, I'm in touch wood like a lot right now. I've never had bad weather, anyone with illness, nothing. Like we haven't even been rained out.
That's good.
In 10 years of all. And, you know, you're in a season that usually you would get this sort of stuff. I showed up to a trip in New Zealand with a couple of my mates, and the whole of New Zealand was under massive cyclone weather. and the wettest part of the entire country down the bottom of the South Island, a place just past a Haast called Jackson's Bay, gets the most round out of the whole country almost, was fine. And that's where I was hunting. The rest of the country was under cyclone. Just absolute fluke. So, yeah, we've been a bit lucky with that, but hopefully it continues.
Mate, I'll have to get some of your luck. The last one was in New Zealand for a World Cup, and we were playing and we had a tornado hit. Like, I remember being on the field. We played the first half, and then there's this thing, you get undercover, there's a tornado within 5 kilometres from the stadium. So we're like all bunkered down under the stadium, and it was like, it's a tornado. Usually you get cyclones, but this was a tornado. Yeah, it was crazy. I was just like, what the hell is going on here? But that seems to be my luck. I'm very blessed with luck in the sense of like my children and family and whatnot. But when it comes to the other side, like, you know, winning a ballot like or something like that, I've got no chance. I still enter everything, but I really do struggle in that sort of thing.
My wife will tell me that I have all the luck. So I'm just trying to kill all the bings and bongs going on in the background here. It's that busy, busy time with a crew of people trying to book hunts and all of that sort of stuff. So it's gone. Sorry.
I bet.
Yeah, it's chaos at the moment. We were talking about this just offline, right?
Well, let's get into it now.
Yeah, this will air whenever it is. But we're right in the middle of booking time for the Fallow Rut. Hugely busy time for anyone that's wanting to hunt the peaks. Ballots have been drawn and, you know, people are trying to book the Hanging Rocks and the Nundles up this way, and I imagine most of the parks down your way as well. So if Joey's listening to your podcast, DPI Joe, what's going on with the servers, champ? Like, the thing is crashing. it's not dealing with it. I don't know if there's more volumes of people than ever, but last year I was via satellite link on Norfolk Island when I was booking, and I was able to book, parks that were in, heavy, heavy competition with only 5 spots, and I was able to do it. This year we're getting 10, 12, 15 minutes worth of site crashes before you manage to get your spot. So something weird's going on.
I think the volume. I was talking to a mate the other day because I made a bit of a mistake this time in saying I wasn't doing the whole get up at midnight to try and book my forest. I wanted to hit Maragal North again. I was able to get that last time, and I went, okay, got my dates. I want to go there. Oh, I won't need to get up because last time there was like 20-odd spots. So yeah. I don't need to rush or anything. It was like literally I booked a couple of weeks out, changed the dates here and there. There was no issues for me last year. And I was there when they were croaking at the end. And this year, holy crap, they're all gone. Like straight away. I was talking to a mate trying to plan. I was like, nah, man, we'll be right. Like it's, there's a lot of spots in there. Bang, gone. And I was just like, oh, maybe there's way more hunters, which I think is a great thing. Like it sucks that I'm not going to be able to get to the forest I want to. But like that's part of it, and it's public land hunting. So I've got a couple other forests I'm happy to hit, and it's one of those good on the people that got those spots over me, and probably a bit of a kick up the backside for me next year to make sure that I'm getting on when staying up late and having a crack to get onto it. But
yeah,
look, it's just public land hunting at the end of the day,
isn't it? Yep, and we all advocate for more hunters doing more to do more of it, and here we are, with some competition. So good on people for doing it. It's not the only time you can hunt. Like, it's the peak of the rut, sure. Some people will say that was last week. Some will say it's next week. I think it's this week based on where I'm going. So I'm a bit more nervous about it than normal. I could just go next week when it's a bit quieter. There's still going to be bucks around, lots to chase. But, we've got a crew of 30 people. And, I'm at the mercy of the system as well. So I could organize a crew of 30 and not get a spot to hunt. good luck to them. And no, I would not show up. I'd go anyway because it's a great time. But it's difficult, yeah.
So just in case our listeners who listen to my podcast don't listen to yours, and I really do think they all cross over personally, in case they don't, will you do something which I absolutely love? I love the idea of it. And I'm thinking maybe next year I might even do something similar down south. And, I think it's a brilliant thing. Not that I'm an expert by any stretch of the imagination. I'm definitely not. But just being able to get people together and have a good time and enjoy being in the outdoors and getting out for a hunt. So what you guys do is a hunter's camp during the rut, and you do it up there in Nundle. Yep. And Hanging Rock, I believe, as well, is where you usually camp. But there was issues with that. If people want to hear about that, I'm sure they can jump over and listen to your podcast. Then You just, I mean, it's booming. I know a few of my mates who are going up there, and I had planned to get up there, and then I sort of went, well, you know what? I want to have a real good crack at the rut. I'm going to go south because it's closer. I know the forests and really put time in there. So that was the only reason I didn't. Plus, then I heard about all these people. And, you know, originally there was 40-odd people that said they were going. And
oh, it was more. 75 on a wait list.
There you go. Yeah. That was what I was looking at. I saw the going and the maybes. I think it going was 45 at one stage and then there's maybes and they were way higher than that. And I looked at it and went, Jesus, there's not that many spots in the forest.
No, but you know, again, this comes down to
trickiest.
This comes down to how to manage the rules and how to manage the bookings. And you're right, there's not enough room for everyone. And I say it's 75 on a wait list. There's 75 people that have indicated they'd like to come, and there are about 30, a little over 30 that have said they will come. And when you join our hunt camp, and the whole concept of our hunt camp is to put into practice the things that we talk about on the podcast. So, you know, each podcast has its niche. We like to think that Mark will talk about it a lot, average Joe safaris. As much as we possibly can, we advocate for what the average Joe can do. You know, we're not trying to be that guy out there that's got access to everything, that can go and hunt anytime he wants and shoot an animal anytime he wants. And, you know, it's great to see that stuff. I like to watch that stuff on YouTube as well and see some really cool things, but, you know, and listen to some good content. But at the end of the day, we're trying to help people go hunting. So the content we try and create, it's not all like that, but the majority of what we create, if you see us doing it, you can do it as well. And, you know, and then we talk about the things that you might need, the things to consider, you know, weather gear, all of that sort of stuff that we all like to talk about to get involved with that type of hunting. So we lean all over public land to be able to do it. Now, we're all Queensland-based. We have no access to public land up here, so we're all traveling. Again, we can do it. You can do it. Get out there and go and do it and have fun. And the proof of it comes by the group of people that want to then come to hunt camp. And it's a big mix. We've got people that come that don't hunt. They want to come and hang out. They want to be part of the camp. They want to show people how to butcher an animal when it comes into camp and make something of that. We've got young hunters that have never shot an animal before that are desperate to shoot an animal, and we'll help them find that animal, the habitat, the locations. We'll give them some things to go and find and look for. They bring the photos back like, yep, that's a scrape. Yep, that's a rub. If you now stay on that contour line and walk around that river system on the same contour line, you're probably going to find four or five more scrapes. If you are, that's good. Now go cut a track in there so that you've got easy, quiet access in. Put your chair down. You know, we give them those tips and tricks and advice to give them the best opportunity to see deer. After that, it's up to them. If they can't pull a trigger, if they're not in range with a bow, you know, we've done everything we possibly can. But if they do get that animal, and sometimes it's a two-year process, one of the characters that comes along, he came with his bow the first year. He did exactly what we said. He had animals walking in front of them, but they were just out of range. And that is, you know, the bow hunter's lot, right? Yeah. The next year he came back with his rifle. We went to the exact same spot, did the exact same thing, and he shot his first buck on the first day. And it was amazing. Like, he got to bring his buck back into camp. The whole camp celebrated with him. It was amazing. Like, we hung it up. We butchered it. He got to take it home. He savored every bit of it, and he learned a ton. And he's hooked on it. He absolutely loves it. And we've got loads of people with similar sorts of stories. So that's what Hunt Camp is. It's free. We don't charge money for it. We allow people to opt into an optional, you know, $50, $60, $70 prize pool, if you like. We've got some pretty cool sponsors that work around us or with us. So they donate some things, and, you know, if you come into camp, then you get the option of, you know, photography competitions or campfire dessert cooking or, you know, first buck into camp. You know, we make it accessible to everybody, but you might go away with a pair of Steiner LRF binos or a Zolio with a year six subscription or something like that, that, you know, is sort of around the gear that we talk about. So it's just a cool environment that people love. And you immerse yourself in hunting for, you know, 7 to 10 days. You're not coming in and then going home again and then having to deal with what's going on at home and family and work and emails and all that crap. You don't even really have text messages unless you go look for them. So you get to go out and hunt and come back and share and, you know, and talk about what's going on and get excited and G'd up by everyone. And then you go to bed dreaming about it. And then you're back up again at 4 o'clock and you're out there doing it again. And it's just a really fun, you know, supportive activity, and I just love it. It's great. And I donate my rut to it every year. you know, I could go off and do my own thing as well. And next year probably we will, because we might change the date and come down your direction and do the same thing with Samba and bring in some Samba resident experts from down that way and just sort of change it up a bit. But the concept is practical learning, and you're a teacher, you know how it works. Not all of us are scholars. Doing it and being in the field and getting your hands grubby works really well for blokes, I reckon.
Oh, 100%. That's how I learn best. Just getting out there, making mistakes, doing it, playing around and seeing what works, what doesn't. And that's been how my journey's gone. And I love it. I wouldn't change a thing, because that's how I learn best. And it's sort of offset. I love the theory side. I do like researching. It's just probably the geek in me. That's why I became a teacher.
Don't we all?
And that stuff, like learning about new products and things like that, and then throwing it into practice and applying it, seeing what goes wrong, seeing what goes right, and going, okay, I did that. But understanding why it went wrong, that's the big one for me, not just making mistakes and not knowing. So that's been a really good thing. And it's been an interesting one, because it's a tricky one. I've been in a couple of hunting clubs and I didn't like them. They were really clicky. I just wasn't for me. I just sort of shied away from it. It's not something that I liked. And I'm going to keep trying different clubs, because I do feel that there's clubs out there that are not like that, or that it's not as prevalent and there's not the arrogance and things like that around some of those things. So I'm going to keep trying with them. And I know a lot of people jump in for those, but I haven't had those pleasant experiences. So for me, I've had more pleasant experiences in the solo side and learning. And then the podcast. The podcast has been absolutely unbelievable. And it's probably a selfish thing in the sense that I am very, very lucky to talk to a lot of different people and be able to pick their brains and talk to them. And even you tonight, I can't wait. I know we're going to get into some public land stuff and talk about how you approach it and your thoughts. And I've got a few different questions for you, but that's just, it's gold.
Yeah.
I can't, it's invaluable. I'm so lucky to be able to be in the position that people will talk to me and they'll jump on and we'll have those conversations and I can pick their brain. And by the time this one's come out, I had a couple of great ones. You know, there was a really good red deer one. There was a really good one with Dylan Smith from Wild to Life. And there's so many different ones there that I sit there and go, oh, geez, that makes sense. Yeah, okay, I didn't think of it from that angle. Now I do, and I'm going to try that out and whatnot. So it is absolutely fantastic. I do love the hunting camp because you get to play with some pretty cool stuff. It's one thing I'm envious of you blokes at. You've got some pretty cool sponsors and you get some pretty cool gear to play with. And I'm a massive tech head. So seeing you guys get to do that, I love watching when you post about it and you're talking about it, because I froth on that and I'm sitting there going, oh, what have they got now?
It's crazy. And sometimes you got to pull yourself up, because the stuff, like it's good to look at. You can see other people, they get it, and there's a bit of envy around it, but there's a lot of work. You know, how long does it take you to sight in a rifle?
Yeah. Oh, probably for me now.
Effort, book the range, get the time, go down, do it, you know, all of that. New rifle,
hour?
4 or 5.
Probably an hour now.
Oh, to actually sight it in. But I mean, from you got your rifle that you posted up today, right? Your fancy new gun.
Ticker, yeah, Aspire. Ticker. Ooh, it's nice.
How long before you will have it sighted in from now until it's ready to hunt?
Oh, this weekend.
This weekend.
You've
booked it, you're ready.
Yeah, I've been hanging, right. Got so it.
So then range. Someone sends you another scope. Oh, shit, I got to book next weekend. But I like that one. Yeah, okay. I like that scope. That was a really good scope that I had, and I'm ready to go to the hunt, but then this other one comes down. I'm not saying it's a bad thing. I'm just saying that the work and the effort that goes into some of that stuff can be interesting. But you do see some cool stuff. We're off to a block this weekend to put this InfiRay tube on. That we've had for a little while, and it's you know, it's their top end $8,000 thermal scope. It's a beautiful piece of gear and it does some amazing stuff, so we're really keen to see how it gets on. You know, when we're pre-rut, there's bucks in the area, we're going to be able to see some stuff at night time. It's on private property and we're just really going to give it a good play with, and we've got 3 or 4 other thermals around that do it as well. So yeah, the tech is really fun, but it's also as much as we love it, quite distracting to try and get yourself prepped and ready to go, you know, for a hunt. Yeah, the hunt's probably, you know, it's 8 weeks away really, but a pre-hunt would be good and those sorts of things. So yeah, there's pros and cons with it, but it is enjoyable for sure.
I think that's everything in life though, isn't it? Like I talk about the podcast and talk about getting to talk to a heap of people, but geez, there's a lot of time and effort away from the family doing it and going through the whole process, organising and things like that. So it's sort of that trade-off.
Yeah, for sure. You've got to love it.
Pick and I had a really good I had one yesterday with a four-wheel driver, and he's quite a large presence in the industry, and he spends a lot of time and effort doing what he does, and it's absorbing. And you know, I don't want to be famous. And I said to him, I said, I'm glad you're out there because I love watching your stuff, and I've been a fan for, I don't know, 7-8 years now. And I said, but I really sit there and go, man, I'd hate to be in your situation because everybody knows him.
Yeah.
And he's in that position. If he goes anywhere, people are coming up to him and talking to him and things like that. And it's one of those things that I think you sort of then, I don't know, I think there's a fine line. That's why I really only focus on the podcast and whatnot. And, you know, I'm a nobody, so I'm pretty confident no one's ever going to come up and want to talk to me or anything like that from a
You get your name out there pretty quick. People will recognize your voice.
I'll have to start using some vocal changes or something then, but because it's not what I'm in it for, no, that's for sure.
And look, no, I don't think, you know, anyone that's doing what we're doing is in it for fame and glory. That's not, you know, you're not going to quit your day job doing this work. We're doing it because we really enjoy it. We meet some fantastic people. We get some really cool experiences out of it. And, you know, that's what I really enjoy. It's just meeting the people is great. The success on new hunters in State Forest, like we get two or three people messages a week. I got my first one. And it's just so bloody good.
I think that's what I love about you guys is there's no ego and arrogance, and it's all about helping. It's not about making money. It's not about selling the business or trying to sell products as well. It's literally you guys are there and you want to help people. And I know you give up a lot of time on the side, and I know you do because I've spoken to people that have done it with you, that, you know, you mentor them and you spend some time with them and really talk them through. And I love it. I think it's just amazing that we need it. We need good people out there that are not trying to make money, that are just trying to be good people and good leaders and mentoring the next generation, because that's going to help all of us and it's going to help the sport. And I think that is important. And without that, because everyone's different. As I said, I have had some pretty bad experiences with hunting clubs. I've had some pretty bad experiences with guides. I've lost a 50% deposit with someone that's just ghosted. There's been a couple of things. So I've sit there and it makes me tentative now to go and see a guide or work it with a guide.
Yeah,
or,
you know, I understand that.
That to me is a bit sort of like, oh, you know, we got smashed on that. Then, and that was like early days of my hunting career. That was just like bang, first type of deer. Oh, sweet, we'll go out and, you know, learn the ropes, and that happened. So that wasn't great. And then a couple of bad experiences with hunting clubs. So then I sort of turned to what else is out there. And for me, you know, whether it be accessible, whether it be people are just more introverted and they don't want to get into those, they don't feel confident enough or whatever it might be, the fact that you guys are putting it out there, your YouTube stuff, your tutorials, your ability to just correspond, I love it. It's so good and it's what we need, and there's some really good ones out there. You know, I love Lawson. He's such a great bloke. Zach's a great guy and what he's doing. And mate, we could go on forever. There's heaps of podcasts now, and I think that's a good thing because whether they listen to me or you, it doesn't matter.
They're all quite different. They are. And even when I, you know, we had a chat with Lawson the other night and we know that he's been on a couple already, but the conversations are quite different. There doesn't seem to be a whole lot of tell us about how you got into hunting anymore. You know, the podcasts seem to have matured a bit. They're bang, they're into it. They're talking about a subject and they're topical. Like, it's just really good. I love listening to them. Aussie content's hard to come by. It used to be really hard to come by. So, you know, putting the stuff out there, I think it's gold. I laugh listening to my own ones when we're editing them because sometimes it can take 3 or 4 weeks to get to them. And I still laugh at some of the stuff that comes out. So yeah, it's good. It's entertaining.
Oh, it is. I think that's the big one. You're exactly right, is that everybody has their own style and their way of talking and questioning, and the paths are just so different. I've had a couple of people on that have been on others, and it's nothing like what they were on the previous one. And that's great. That's not a bad thing. And if it was, it'd be super boring. And it's not, because people keep tuning in and they keep tuning into the different ones, and they're just so different, which I do love. Mate, let's talk about the fallow rut, because I've been picking people's brains because I, especially State Forest, I've had a few people that are more private and they've talked about some different things. I am really wanting to hone in on the public, I think it's a massive challenge. And that is exciting to me. And I want to talk about how do you approach it in the sense that is there plans prior? How good are the plans prior? Because, you know, I sit there and I look at the GPS maps. I jump on Google Earth and I go, okay, this makes sense as to where they will be. And then you get boots on the ground and you're like, Jesus Christ, this is terrible.
This is gnarly country. Yeah, yeah.
Exactly. Yeah, it's just, it's not conducive to good hunting. I'm going to make a shitload of noise. Doesn't matter how quiet I try to be. I can't see a couple of meters ahead. That doesn't work sometimes. Or there's been times I've got down there and it's been cut. And just a full clear cut now, and it's just like, oh man, this has changed my whole thought process.
Yes.
How much do you plan, and how much do you sit there and go, hey, just we're going to have to run with
it? So much, so much, so much planning, and then so much changing of plans. All of what you just said is accurate. Now, to me, it comes down to where you hunt, because we can say public land, but not all public land is the same. I hunt some blocks out west, and it's just scrubby Casuarina type deserty, you know, shitty bush blocks that used to be used as leases for cattle, and they've been let go, and you know, there's some good stuff in them, but like there's nothing much to it. There's a track that runs around it, maybe through the center of it, but that's about it. That's goat country, if I think about that. And then there's the stuff that I tend to hunt that has got deer in it. You know, the Nundles, the Hanging Rocks, you know, the parks up and down the New England, things like that. Usually they're forestry blocks. So if I think about forestry blocks, you were talking about clean cut. You're probably talking about a forestry block.
Yep.
Forestry blocks for me are easier to pre-plan because there is some structure to it. And that main structure is you've got your land, whatever the landscape looks like. It's been planted. It's usually planted from the highest aspects down to the riparian zone, which is the zone about, call it 100 to 200 meters off the creek. Okay. And normally the gap between the creek riparian zone, which is going to be the native country that sits on the creek bed. My opinion is the reason that they don't plant that is because they don't want invasive trees, being pines, dropping seeds in the waterways. I mean, it makes sense, right? So there's yep. rules about where they can plant. And usually the border of the pines and that zone or the eucalypt is a track because the forestry have got to get around the track. So
yep.
for starters, I believe personally, fellow like native country more than they do pines. It's not to say they're not going to be in the pines. I see them going through the pines, but they're usually on their way to native country. And that's because the girls like to eat down in the creeks by the water because that's where the clover comes up. That's where the nicer grass comes up. Under pine trees, it's pretty sparse picks, right? So it just naturally they want to hang out down there. So if you think about that, we've got pines, I've got a track, and now I've got 100 to 200 meter zone between here and the river, the creek, and then it goes up the other side for 200 meters, that's a perfect shooting zone.
Yep.
You're on a clear track, you've got quiet access, and you can see usually down towards that creek. So you've got a 200 meter zone, which is what you really want to be shooting in public land, under 200 meters. So that's how I start to think about the areas that I want to go. Then there's going to be areas that have large areas of eucalypt because it's inaccessible for the machines to get in to do the planting or whatever reason. It's just they haven't planted it. And these are the areas that you talk about that are hard to get into. They look more appealing to the hunter on paper because there's no tracks that go into it, so there's more distance. You know, the bold that likes to go down the steep gullies and put in the effort is probably going to find the better animals because it's less pressure, all of that sort of stuff. But I've always found that there are tracks into those areas if you spend enough time scouting for them. And you can find them when you do your e-scouting. You know, you go on to SixMap. SixMap's another product like Google Earth. It's got a much better, what do you call it? It's not clarity, but you know what I mean.
Yep.
It's a much clearer image that's gone across. They do it, you know, they've zoomed in a lot more on it. So you get a lot more detail, and you can find those tracks if you really analyze the area that you're trying to go. And there's areas that I went only recently that I've said, I really want to go down into that area because it's a long way from everywhere else. And my goal for this trip is to find my way into there. And you can see on the map there's rivers that intersect and they come into the base of it and it forms a nice basin, which is where I think the animals like to hang out, which is proven time and time again. That's what they like. So I take Cicatiers and I find my spot and I cut tracks, like just small tracks so that I can get in. And I've got a dog, doesn't like blackberries. all that sort of stuff. So I'm trying to be nice to the dog that doesn't have to go through the blackberries. All of that, I cut my way down if I need to find access into that area. And then usually you're going to be sitting on a shelf that looks down over the basin, and you get good vantage points. So you need to explore it. If you're going into the rut, having not ever been to a place, then really that rut for you is going to be about exploring and less about hunting. You've got to spend some time. Now, you can get lucky. There's no doubt about it. You can bump into stuff. But if you don't know where your quiet access is to start with, then the chances are you're going to see the back end of those animals as they run off. You know, and if you're going to let fly at those, then, you know, have a think about what you're doing. But that's sort of where you're up to. Now, when I talk to the new hunters, when they come into camp, I was talking about it earlier, you want to go and find rub trees. Now, we know what rub trees look like, but they're different whether it's reds or fallows. Reds like to take on big trees. We all see reds and samba, big rub trees, big preach trees. You know, they're sharpening it while they're rubbing off, leaving scent, doing everything they're doing, but they take on big trees. Fallow, they like things about the size of your thumb. Yep. They don't like big trees. They like to win fights, and they take on little trees. And it's really easy to find because there's a whole bunch of dead shit underneath a stripped-off sapling, basically. Yeah. If you find that, you're in an area. You found an area. Now what you've got to do is get down towards the creeks because the girls like it down there. And if the girls like it down in the creeks, near the creeks, so sort of that 10, 15-meter highway along the creeks, then the bucks are going to be up a terrace so they can watch what the girls are doing. If you're up that terrace off the creek, you're going to find a rub or a scrape, you know, a rutting pad. And the rutting pad's where they clean it off. You'll find an area that's, you know, maybe 3 by 3 meters that's clear dirt under a tree, often a tree fern, a fern tree, a grass tree, you know, the tree ferns. They really, yep. really like it under those. And an area that they can look down into the creeks. You find one of those, you follow the contours, you find 5 or 6 more of them or 4 or 5 more of them on the same contour line. You've found the habitat is really what I'm trying to say there. If you've found those things, you're in a place where there's deer. Those bucks will come back to those scrapes every 2 days, if not 3 days. So you can throw some pine needles on there, you can throw some sticks on there, some leaves on there, and when you go back every day to check on it, they will have cleaned it. You know it's active. You know you're in an area. So now you've just got to find a spot well above where that guy is with a really good shooting view and then cut your access back out to the track. And it's as simple as I can make it for anybody. Now, there's people that don't like sitting all day, but cut that track down so that when you go in, you're not touching sticks and leaves and logs and stuff and leaving your scent everywhere. Get one of those, you know, LD chairs that you can pack in there and leave it there the whole week. And you go back every day and you sit on it and you can flick leeches for 4 hours if that's what you've got to do. But that buck will come back. He will come back, and if you wait for him, he'll be there. If you're there for a week, almost guaranteed you're going to see that buck come through, and that's all you're looking for. You dream about it for a year. You probably see the girls first. So the question is, can you hold your nerve? Are you going to take the girls or are you going to wait for the buck? Oh, man, there's so much to it, but that's how I assess the ground to start with. That's how I find it. But when I came back from my last trip, I said, here's a great area that I want to explore. I've never been here before. I spent the day looking, and then I took Dave back in to show him the area that I'd found, and we shot a deer because we found the habitat, and it just proved the whole thing worked. When I got back home and I jumped on Google Earth, I could see the track that I found that wasn't on the maps, but I could see it because I knew where it was. You know what I mean? Once you know, you can't miss it.
Yep.
If you spend enough time looking at Google Earth and Six Maps, you're going to find those little tracks that go down into those gullies to give you that quiet access, and that's the important part of the puzzle.
You said a couple of things there. I didn't even think about it, and it makes so much sense. I've never thought about throwing anything on a scrape.
Mm.
You know, I found them, I log them, and go, okay, that's where I roughly want to. Never even thought about it. It makes complete sense.
Then you know they were here today. They won't be here tomorrow, because often you might run two different sit spots. If you find multiple scrapes, usually they'll have another set on the other side of that ridge that you're looking at, goes down to the creek up the other side. They'll be on the other side. A buck usually works about 4 grid squares or 2 kilometer square. That's sort of their range that they'll work. And you'll have a home range of does that's sort of in about 1 grid square, 1 by 1, 1 by 1. So he might be servicing 2 little groups, 3 little groups in the same area. Yep. So you find both scrapes. But he might be on the other side when you're here. So that's just your opportunity. Wear gloves. Like, for God's sake, don't grab it with your bare hands and throw human scent down on the ground. It sounds so simple, but we all forget these things. Or, you know, get a piece of something or kick it off or do something, but, you know, get a bit of stick on there for them to clean it off, because then you'll know the day he was there last and you know he won't be there tomorrow, and you'll hellishly know he's probably going to be there the next day, and then you'll get excited. Probably won't sleep.
MA says, oh, look, I'm super excited to get into a couple of areas. I had some trail cams out, and I put it up on YouTube, and, you know, there was two different bucks running around the joint, which was super exciting. Yeah. And I know where those scrapes are, and I know where they're moving the rubs and things like that. And I'm hoping they're going to be similar to where their patch is, and they're moving exactly where I thought they'd be moving. So
how long ago were the photos?
Look, that was, what are we talking now? Where are we? Probably about 6 months ago now. So, look, I do know they chase the girls and wherever the girls are, but there are so many girls in that area. So I have seen a lot of girls there. The trail cam was just chockers full of them. I only posted the boys in a Samba stag that I got on there, but I got plenty more. I'll probably need to upgrade the laptop.
I love it when I find them on my trail cams. It's so good.
Oh, man, I was looking at, look, I got probably, oh, look, there's probably 400 videos. I do it a little bit different to you. I know you go the, I think, two shots.
Yeah, I don't do video.
And
I don't do video.
Yeah, I do video only, and I just, I don't know, I love watching them move. It's probably, that's the only reason why.
I was
why.
The same, mate. I got really enthusiastic when I first started using trail cams, and I turned all the features on. Everything was on, guns blazing, because I wanted all the data I could possibly get, and I was really keen. But then I started leaving trail cams out for a year.
Yeah.
And you can't do that if you leave video on, not with cheap trail cams. And you don't put expensive trail cams in state forests because you're probably not going to pick them up. I mean, I've left trail cams.
Yep.
Let's be honest with you. I started leaving trail cams in deep, dark gullies for a year because I couldn't be bothered going back and getting them, and I was happy to sacrifice the $100. But when I went back the next year and found it was still there and still functional, 12 months later, still taking photos, to look back and watch a deer, a specific deer, grow out across my trail cam over a year.
That's cool.
Through the snow, then through the spring and through the floods and all of that, day in, day out, this buck was coming through and you could watch that. That was way more interesting to me than one 3-second video.
Okay, so I run 30-second videos.
God, how long did the battery last? You got it on solar.
No, mine's fine. I had them out there for 4 or 5 months and no issue good whatsoever. Job. Had heaps of battery left, to be honest, and heaps of storage left in the memory card as well. And I didn't even have the max memory card in. Yeah. So I was sort of sitting there going, this is probably pretty spot on. I have a mix. I have a couple from cheapies from Amazon.
Yep.
Got a couple from Amazon. They're sort of no brand sort of ones. They're the ones I actually had out there for so long. Yep. And then I got a couple of Ridgeline cameras as well. And I didn't leave the Ridgelines one in there because they're worth a little bit more money. I tend to sort of not want to leave them. I'll take them if I'm in the area, put them out for a couple of days and whatnot while I'm sort of floating around, but I'll take them home. But the other ones, I'm more than happy if someone knocks them off, it's not the end of the world. Where I do like the Ridgeline ones, they're pretty good kit, so I don't really want them stolen. But it's, yeah, look, I had no issue, and I had 400 videos.
Yeah, it is good.
It was great, and watching them and watching how they interact, and some of the spots I had them in, they were just feeding big groups, chilling out, and it was really interesting to see how they interacted and how they were looking and things like that. I like to do that and just sort of sit there and go, they're so different watching the Samba versus the fallow. Holy crap, they're a totally different.
In what way?
Their mannerisms, they just look like they're sneaking around compared to the fallow.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
Even I got a hind in her. Look, it looked like a yearling. I might be off. I'm not super great with Samba. And watching it move probably a good 20 meters in front of it, and how it was almost that the little one would be still, watch the other one move, and she'd go looking around full on edge. And mind you, this is in the middle of the night too, some of these. And then she'd stop, then the little one would play a little bit of catch up. It was almost that it would never catch up to her. There was always a good sort of 10, 15 meter gap, but it was obvious, not so much in the dark, but I got some really good video in the daytime, and they just happened to be like elongated on one of the trails that I was looking at, and you could see what was going on, how they'd move sort of like a little bit, I'll go for a bit, you go for a bit, I'll go for a bit, you go for a bit. And it was really interesting to watch how they moved, how they were so alert compared to fallow. Totally different.
Yeah.
Totally different, yeah. Which was, for me, that's fascinating.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, look, I think for me, any footage you can catch of wild deer, if you love a deer, like if that's your thing, which it is for me, like I could care less if there were pigs. Whatever, get out of the way. It's the deer I'm chasing. And any footage I can get of my own, it's all about my own. Like if someone else shows me 1,000 photos of their own stuff, I'm not really that interested. Cool, good on you. But for me, it's about the process that I go through and what I can put out there and what I can capture and the data that I can get, because I know where I want to go back to use that information, right? So, yeah, everyone's got a bit of a personal connection to their own footage. But, yeah, for me, I never would have thought that a camera with video settings on would have lasted 12 months, but even 6 months seems crazy.
Five months.
And some of these shit cameras, they're hit and miss. They could drain a battery in 2 weeks and then another one lasts a year. I don't understand what happens to them. Yeah. But
yeah. Well, I had the Ridgeline out the back of on my property because we were having issues with foxes and things chasing the chooks. And to be honest, I totally forgot the bloody camera was there on the fence. And I left it out, same thing, video on there, and I left it out for 6 months and same deal, no issue. Mm. Battery was still good. Videos were a lot of them, more us moving during the day because we forgot they were there. So the every week at the same time I'm there mowing away and but it was all there. But it was really interesting that I think you're right. I've had other ones. I think I had a King's camera and that was really battling. It was terrible with photos, I found, and they were pretty ordinary. But then the video was a lot better, but it drained the battery a lot quicker than anything else that I had too. Yeah. If I had two out in the same, that was cooked early. The other one was better. But the other ones, the only thing that sucks about the other ones I got from Amazon, their dates, they don't hold the date well. Date and time.
I found that as well. That 12 months that I had, I was struggling to figure out what order things were in.
Yeah.
Yeah. But anyway, I still got
that. That's part of it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Good fun. It's $100. It is one of those things. All right. What about the mornings? Because I'm one that I've always sort of shied away from getting out there in the complete darkness because I feel that I make enough noise during the daylight. Do I try and get in early into the spot I want to get to under red light? Is that what you're doing? I mean, you hunt a little bit different because you got the dog, but if you're not got the dog with you, are you getting out there to find a spot like super early in the dark or are you waiting for light?
Not find a spot.
You're hearing I'm going anyway. To my
spot. I'm not looking for a spot. Yeah, I know where I'm going. I've spent the time over the years, going back. This is why it's so good to adopt the forest. Like, there's animals in the park you're going to. You're not coming to the social camp. You're going to your spot. You've done the work. You deserve the rewards. Like, that's where you're going. And the only thing that I could suggest that you do if you haven't done it already is know where your sit spot's going to be. And like I said, take your secateurs and chop all that stuff out of the way that you're going to touch. And do it early. So that you're not touching it stuff every time you walk in there. You're just telling everything that you are there. And then they'll disappear and they might not come back for 2 or 3 days. And sometimes we only have 2 or 3 days to go hunting.
That's me.
Right. So
I have 3 days max.
You gotta be prepared, be well before the rut to make sure that where you're going is right. Now you might not be a sitter. You might be a spot and stalk type of person and then that all changes. So but that's not what I recommend people do. When they're early into their hunting and they're trying to get some success, patience becomes the important part. Now, yes, I do hunt with a dog. So I've got an indicator. She's great. She finds me deer. But I don't – even my morning hunts, I will be under red light, up super early, and getting into my spot an hour before light, first light, so that I can be there. So I'm there an hour before first light so I can walk in there at that half-hour period before first light because that's when you're allowed in to do it.
Yeah.
And there's some people will disagree with it. You can't be hunting before half an hour before first light. And walking into your spot technically is part of hunting. I've had this conversation with them, right? We've had the conversation with various different people and we'll debate this all night. Part of your activity of hunting is walking in and going hunting. You can't say you're bird watching. You can't say you're this and that. Technically, part of that. Hunting is not just shooting. Hunting is walking. Hunting is looking. Hunting is binos. Hunting is the whole process that you're in is hunting. So that moving from the car and to your spot, technically you shouldn't do before half an hour before. Plenty of people will. Yep. Plenty of people dispute that. That's cool. But for me, I've been pulled up on that. I always thought I could be there 3 hours before, let everything settle down. Everything sort of gets back to normal. And then I'm not going to shoot until first light. I'm glassing, yep. looking around, everything's good. But that's kind of hunting, aren't I?
Yeah, but then I look on the flip side. What about of an evening? If you're out there and you're allowed to sit and stay till half, but you're walking back, you're now not hunting because you're walking back to your car.
You're right.
The same logic.
Well, no, because you're walking out. You're walking away from your hunt.
Yeah,
it's a tough one. Anyway, let's not even try and debate that.
No, I get it. Yeah. I see both sides.
I started looking at thermals. That you are when thermals hunting. Became allowed, I was yep. like, oh, cool. I'll go in 2 hours before hunting time. I'll suss out what's in the valleys. I'll know there's deer yep. in there before shooting light. Retract. Can't do that because that is part of your hunting process. You've got a permit
understand
on you.
That.
Got your gun. You're walking in. You're looking for yep. prey.
I understand that. But if you're just walking to your spot to sit there and you're doing it under red light, you're not seeing animals while you're under red light.
No, you're not.
Yeah. Mate, as you said, we could debate this.
Not even worth debating. But I've now pulled myself up. I used to go in much, much earlier and yep. sit. But then I also found that when I changed the way I hunted to this riparian zone concept where there was usually a track that then hit the boundary of pines and eucalypt, and I could then just walk off that track down a couple of terraces that I've chopped the track in, I'm really not that far a walk in by the time I drive and park. So I get in the car so that I can spend a few minutes walking down to where I need to be, and then I'm sitting and I'm waiting until first light. And at that point in time, the world's settled down a little bit, and you know you've got really good opportunity to take animals in that early light.
Look, makes sense. I do actually want to pick your brain here because one of the things I'm thinking about, I don't know if you've seen them, the Hick Micro Alpex. Man, they look insane. Yep. I've been sitting there toying up going, I need a scope for the new Tigger.
No.
Do I go a standard one? I do love tech. Do I look at the Hick Micro because it looks unbelievably good? Now, my concern with that, having it on a rifle that I'm in a state forest, is I don't know if you've seen some of the footage on it, but forget the IR light because you don't even need the damn thing. I put it up on Ben Hunt the Night's group and said, hey, guys, what are these like in twilight? And I got a couple of people show me and it was just like, what the bloody hell?
Forget twilight. It's daylight. Daylight.
It's black and daylight.
Like 10 o'clock colored. In the morning, it's sweet. Especially in the rut when it's cold.
Man, I couldn't believe it. I was just sitting there going, this is insanely...
I'm mucking around with this entry-level thermal, right? It's as good now as it is at 10 o'clock in the morning. Now, in summer, you're going to get some hot rocks and some hot trees. Change the color palettes. You get over that pretty quickly. And once you're used to your thermal, you know what's going on.
Well, the Alpex is only day-night. But it's not the thermal, but my God, it's still good. It's I think bloke over in Western Australia, I think was it? He's a contract shooter and he put up a video. It's black. Like he's got his phone and he's just scrolling around and it's black, pretty much pitch black. And then he puts it into the scope and no IR and it's color and you can see everything. And I was like, Jesus Christ. My concern about throwing that on interstate forest is that I don't know how I feel about that. If you, as you said, you're walking out and you've got that on standby, even if you've got it off, technically they don't know. And I don't know, it's a very gray, blurry line. And I like to operate in black and white. I like to say, hey, I'm doing everything completely legal. So I'm not, that concerns me. Like private property doesn't matter, get it. But on a state forest hunt, I'm sitting there going, this is... I don't know how you'd get around it. I don't even know if removing the batteries would be acceptable. And, yeah, it's one of those tricky ones. I'm probably going to have to speak to someone at DPI and say, hey, what is the go
here? I think getting over that's quite simple, mate. You don't have the bolt or the ammunition in your gun. It doesn't matter whether the thermal's on by accident or not. You can't shoot it.
Okay, and I've thought about that. But then I've also gone, what if, say we're there, and it happened to me down the Snowies. I was lucky enough, a mate took us out onto a block. We were on two sides of the block and there was someone shooting on the block and it wasn't us. Yep. So we're sitting there going, he thought I'd shot, I thought he'd shot, neither of us had shot. That's concerning because someone's on there that shouldn't be. And I was sitting there going, okay, what if I'm in a state forest? And I'm always, mate, I'm like always think about worst case scenario because I don't want to be doing the wrong thing or perceived to be doing the wrong thing. That's just what I'm about. And I was like, what if I'm in the state forest? DPI around, they've seen me car, they're waiting for me to come back. I'm walking back, as you said, bolt out, I'd do that. I'd probably take the, if I did have it, I'd probably even take the battery out. I know you can do that in the Alpex. Well, I think you can do it. There is one battery that comes out. But what if someone shoots that's in there within a certain distance that sounds like it could have been me? And I get back there and it's after shooting light and he's like, well, hold on, mate. You've got this product that can shoot. Like, I just, I don't know. Like, I know it wouldn't be me, but I also get nervous that it could be assumed to be me. And look, there's a lot of stars lining up there too.
I've never, ever considered that as an issue. But I've never thought about that as a concept that could happen. And saying that, almost every year where I've been hunting for the last five or six of an evening, someone quite close has let off a round. So the scenario is absolutely right.
Yeah.
What is the ranger going to do? Shit, mate, I don't know. There's a whole lot of sniff test going on in that. The ranger's got a
100%.
You know, you're the guy in camo. You've showed back up here. If there's another guide, usually they're pretty good at knowing there's more than one car in the area. They got cameras up. They know what's going on. They're pretty damn good at understanding that. So, you know, for you to be able to say there's someone else in here that's let that off, you're probably going to go, okay, cool. There's another car there or whatever. I don't know. It's a difficult one. Is it likely to happen? No.
Probably
do
not.
You need to worry about it? It's good to be cautious. Should you put a thermal scope on your State Forest rifle to start with? No. What are you going to do when one bounces in front of you? Quick smart, right? It's not exactly a quick acquisition scope.
Well, these ones are, from talking to a couple of people,
they're good,
using
but
them.
They're not as good as glass in terms of just up and quick reactive shooting.
Well, I actually asked a couple of guys that, because that was my other concern, going, what is the HIC Micro like? How quick is it on standby? Is it on? Is it thing? And most of the guys said, man, it's incredible. Mm. It's just like a normal scope and it's a digital zoom. So like your picture quality is absolutely amazing. Like the 4K version, I think, is just landing.
Crazy.
And from what people are saying, man, it's crazy. It's crazy good.
Worth
so
a trial,
it's sort of like, I don't know.
Yeah, interesting. I don't know if I can answer your question. I personally wouldn't put a thermal on my State Forest rifle. Because so many of the animals that I have opportunities on are fast. Like it's quick reactive. It's in front of you. It's right now. It's no mucking about with buttons, up and go. To the point, we've trialed thermals in State Forest. They work great. Never seen a deer in one. Never.
Mm.
Never, ever have I seen a deer in the thermal in State Forest. Not to say you won't. Others will.
Yep.
But what I do find is it helps me clear what's in front of me to tell me there are no deer and I can move on. That's what I've found it's been really helpful for. So the monocular
scanner
has been more helpful in that area. The tool of choice for finding deer for me is the dog. She knows what she's doing. She's going to be way better than me, but that doesn't work for everybody. Yeah, lots to think about in deciding that. You've got to get one on a rifle, I think, and test its reaction speed.
Well, that's the other thing. At $2,000, and I'm not in the position that anyone's going to give me one just to test out. It's sort of like, well, it's a big expensive tests. So I'm relying on other people talking about it. And what they're saying is that, again, I'm only going off what people are saying, but there's no buttons. So as soon as you pull it up, she's ready to go. So I'm not sure how that looks. So I'm going to try and find as soon as they have like a demo or something that's relatively close that I can actually get out and check it out and see the difference. So
yeah, what if there's a similar InfiRay product out in the market?
Yeah, I don't know. This one's the Apex is pretty new.
I only say that because I'm getting trials and things like that from InfiRay.
Yeah, exactly. So I'm trying to find out.
Yeah, but
well, this one, mate. Even the look of it looks pretty much like it's a tube scope. It's not like your big ATN. Yeah. It doesn't look anything like that. If you don't have the eye sort of piece on at the back, you're probably not telling too much that it is. If it does have the laser rangefinder, it has it looks like a bit of a hood on the front.
Yeah.
So if you don't have that and you just have the standard, it does look pretty awesome from that perspective. And I, it just caught my eye and everything I've sort of seen and has gone, that's just, do I spend something similar money-wise? And then if I'm lucky enough to get onto some private blocks or be able to shoot at night, it covers that as well.
Yeah, yeah.
And I don't have to sort of double up. And then as you sort of said before, throwing scopes on and off and things like that, you don't really want to be doing that because it's a very time-consuming process.
So you've got another
it's just
rifle.
An option I've been sort of tossing.
You've picked up the 308 and
you're
getting rid of the other one?
Yeah, I did. I sold the other 308.
You can't have two setups.
Straight.
Yeah.
No, and then, well, I've got the 243. I've got a 6.5 Creedmoor, but they're set up for a certain way as well. So I sort of, I don't don't really want to do that. So it, I might need a new gun, but it's going to be hard.
It might be old school.
The wife when I just bought one.
I hate to say it. Mark's our old school guy. He likes his old school stuff, but I might be a little bit old school with new tech. And for me, it's the monocular works really well for me because it gives me what I need, but I also have what I need when it turns, you know, when it means I need the optics that I want. But new tech comes all the time. I'm not, there's no right or wrong, I don't think. If it's as good as what you're saying it is, I think, man, what an incredible piece of gear.
Well, that's what I want to look at because I've got the scanner. I've got my monocular, thermal monocular, which I love playing around with that thing. I'm often just go for a drive and check out some cows or whatever because it's just so much fun. And I, you know, I've probably recorded way too much of my dogs running around the backyard. Yeah, yeah, yeah. But, you know, it's just so cool to look through. But that, I don't have anything bar. This current setup is just a normal scope throwing on my Olight, you know. So I sort of want to have something that possibly I do like the idea of the infrared setup because it's not super costly as opposed to a thermal. But then talking to a lot of mates that use thermals, they're like, man, when you get a thermal, you just, you're going to love it and you won't want to go to an infrared one either. So it's just, it's one of those things. You know, each their own. And
so many,
there's too many good things out there now. That's the bloody problem. Like it's almost getting to the point where we're so spoiled for choice. I don't know what
I've heard you say that before. And I smiled when you said it last time as well on one of your podcasts. Like the piece of tech that I really love, the thermal is cool. I like it. But the bit of tech that I've been using that I really, really am enjoying is the auto ranging scopes, you know, the Baris Eliminator scopes. And they've brought out another product which is that looks like a scope. So there, I think the Eliminator 6 is due out and it's a scope profile rather than the big beefy thing on it. And I find that really, really good. You know, we you might not agree with this analogy, but we spend a lot of our lives with our heads in our phones.
Yep.
And when I'm in the bush, I don't want to spend my time in the bush with my head in a scope. You know what I mean? If you've got a thermal, you do a lot of this and you don't have your periphery working very well because you're looking at what the thermal can give you and you get this blindness when you take the thermal away, especially if it's near dark or dark, you get this blindness. A lot of monoculars don't have a rangefinder, so you don't have depth perception.
Yep.
I think great for nighttime. State forest, I really think you need all these sensors going on, the smells, the winds, you know, but if you've got your face in a screen, kind of feel like you're missing out. Whether you're going to be more successful with one or not, my experience is not. But like I said, you know, I'm lucky enough that I've got a trained dog. So outside of the morning time, when we were talking about earlier about what you do in the morning, I take the dog for a walk to find new habitat, to find more scrapes because she finds them. And, you know, where most people have finished their morning hunt, Missy will be pushing deer out of their beds. And if there's an opportunity that one's not running away from me, then, you know, I've just got way more chance than the average bear out there of getting something, which is great.
So you wouldn't be running, you wouldn't really croak or be rattling because you got Missy.
I do. I don't, I used to rattle a bit. I'm not a mad fan of it, but I do like the croaks. I like to, because it brings aggression from those bucks. You know, they really do not like something in their territory. And I find the croaking is not just a deer making a noise. A croaking is a deer making a mating sound. And calling his girls away. You know, two paddles thrashing a tree is an animal in his area for sure, but the mating sound is what I find gets them really G'd up. So
it's almost like buying a drink for a girl that's got a boyfriend and handing it over, isn't it? So
or leaning on the bar next to her, two different things. I'm here, you know, my presence is here. I do use those things in the morning. Or in the evening, if nothing's going on, you need to sort of start firing something up. I find the caller works quite well. Obviously, you're not going to use it outside the rut. I've heard people use them at weird times, but, you know, each to their own. I think all of those tools are helpful.
Yeah. I mean, it makes sense that, I was just wondering because I was thinking, oh, if you've got the dog, are you – well, you using her as a tool, but are you then using other tools as well? Because I haven't had the privilege of going out with anyone with the dog, and I've got two mates that have it, Frank and Gabby, and I'm just really keen at some stage just to, you know, go and follow them and just watch.
It's really hard. It's really hard. Anytime I've taken somebody else out with me, the dog just mucks around.
Okay.
Yeah, it's been Jono, actually, he joined me for a hunt in Hanging Rock 1 year, and she was just a pain in the ass. She wouldn't listen. I was interacting with Jono, so my focus was off her, and she knew it. And it was a disaster. It just wasn't worth hunting.
Yeah, okay.
So we work really well as a team. And not to say don't go out with Frank. I think it'd be great if you could experience it. I find the most useful part of taking the dog is when you've got to track something down. You know, so you've shot an animal and it's run for 15 or 20 meters or 100 meters, having the dog go straight in there and go and get it for you saves you a lot of time. The main reason I got a dog to start with was because I'm horribly colorblind, and I couldn't see blood on anything. You could have a puddle of blood on the leaves in front of me. I can't see it. The only way I could see it is if the light shimmered on it and it showed me a texture change. That's pretty much it. So I just can't see it. Not that I had any animals run away and die on me without me finding them, but I never, ever wanted to be in that situation. And mentoring people, you know, I just wanted the dog to fix that up. Then it just turned into this amazing weapon of a deer finder. She's just nuts. So I love it. It's great. It's the best thing.
I was talking with Frank, and he comes over regularly, and the wife, we were talking about the dog, and I am very a long way. So I'm a very long way away from that. The wife is not keen. She's like, had it up to here with buddy our dogs, and she's like, we are not getting another one, so that you're going to take up more time training something, because you I spend enough time doing a range of other things. Yeah. So that's probably when the kids get a bit older. So I said to Frank, I said, that's where I'll be picking his brain then, probably in about 10 years' time, saying, mate, all right, it's probably time now to get a dog. But
it's good to go through the learning process for a period of time, just doing the basics. You know, introducing a dog adds complexity. Absolutely go and do it, but there's so much that you can do before you level up, I think, to that. The other thing about dogs is if you don't think you're ready, you're not. You're absolutely not, because your whole family, family's got to be on board with training a deer dog. If they are not on board with it, then it's so hard.
My kids are too young. They'd be terrible.
I trained Missy when my son was in his first 2 years. Right. So,
okay. How was his interaction with it? Because I know my two,
not allowed.
Oh, yeah. No, I've got no hope.
Well, that's what I mean.
My three are obsessed family has with to be dogs.
On board. We've got family dogs.
Yeah.
No. This dog, no. Wife's not allowed to play. Kids aren't allowed to play. She lives in a kennel and she's bored. And every time I walk outside, I train her. And she trains because she's bored, and I'm the most fun thing in her life. If she's scragging with the kids with the ball out the back and throwing sticks and logs and shit everywhere, the dog doesn't want to train. It wants to play with the kid. So there was just a hard, fast rule. It's just pretend the dog's not here, because it's not. And I train it. And 12 months after that, we have the most amazing family dog. The best manners, the best everything. You can walk down the main street off a lead. You can take her anywhere. She's not going to run and chase. Nothing. Perfectly obedient. Best family dog we've ever had in terms of training. We've got fat staffies as well that lie around, do nothing. And that's what they're good at. In terms of, I've never in my wildest dreams that I think I could walk down the main street of Sydney with my dog at heel and not worry about it. I'd never thought I could do that. And that's what you can do when you go through this program. Just got to have the right timing.
Yeah. And it'd be a lot of time and effort.
It's not
going
that,
through
it's
it.
Not
it?
That much.
Really?
It's consistent. So I had to get up an hour earlier than normal and sacrifice whatever else I was doing at that time. And maybe that was sleep. So there's a good hour of training in the morning, but that might only be 20 minutes of training and 40 minutes going for a walk or a jog.
Yeah, okay.
And then because I was working at home, I was able to give her another session for 20 minutes in the middle of the day, and I was able to give her another hour at the end of the day. And most of that was under darkness because I had family commitments first. So other than that, honestly, they spend a lot of time in their kennel, and it's not – don't think that's mean. It is hard on people that don't understand the process. But they need to be conditioned to alone time. They need to be conditioned to small spaces. They need to be able to get in a helicopter and not freak out. They need to be able to stay at a hut and not freak out. They need to be able to sleep outside in the snow and not freak out because you're inside. That's all part of kenneling, and it's conditioning. Yeah. And then after 12 months, you do whatever you want. Now she's usually in my office under my feet when I'm working. None of that happens anymore, but she's very switched on and ready to hunt.
For it. Yeah, okay, that makes sense.
So it's doable, but family's got to understand the process.
Yeah. Oh, and look, just the timing you're talking about that, mate. My I don't know how far you, or you said you just work from home. My commute's a good probably hour each way. So I lose a lot of time in that. And then by the time you then add getting kids from daycare and that into it, it's just, you know, I sort of sit there and I joke around saying to the wife when we're a bit closer to home and I'm maybe not working so far, man, I'm probably going to get 2.5 hours straight back into my life each day. So that's a massive amount. And then something like that, maybe then I can start looking at that. But
And like I said, you'll know when it's right and you'll be ready for it and you'll want to level that game up and, you know, it'll just fall into place. I wanted it for probably 10 years. Took me that long to find the right time for it.
Yeah. No, it's good to know because it's something down the track. But, mate, where I'm at the moment, I just love getting out there in the bush and having fun and being out there on my own and looking around. So I don't think it's any time soon, that's for sure, but I do believe it's going to be a, you know, just probably will be something I do want to do just for the different experience too. And I think that's part of hunting and what we do. Just, you know, all these different things is pretty cool. It's the same as the gear and the guns and the, whatever you want. I don't think there's a right and wrong way when it comes to what your preferences are and what you want to do. And, you know, we need that variety in the community as well. Mm. So I do love it. Mate, before we go, I do want to hear what happened to the boat up in Fraser.
Oh, because God. The boat. That was such chaotic Christmas time.
Well, you did better than I did. I went up there and A, I was sick all the time. B, the weather, the winds. I don't think we had a day that was under 25 k's an hour. The old man had the boat out, ready to go, pumped to try and take out, you know, we're taking out the my eldest and he was like, oh, that's the first time he's ever gone, you know, fishing with a grandkid. And he was super excited and there was not a day we could go out. It was just atrocious. So we didn't even get the boat wet, which sucked. You did. Probably more
drowned
wet than
sitting in the driveway because it was that wet. And this was a planned little family holiday. We hadn't been away together as a family for a while. My wife's a competition horse rider, so she's anywhere from here to Adelaide in a liverboard float. She goes and does her thing, work during the day. So, you know, we're a family that gets together on a weekend, maybe once every 5 or 6 weekends. And it works really well. But we were heading away for this Christmas period, or it was just after New Year, and I rang my mate and I said, oh, I take the tinny. So it's not my boat. It's a mate's boat. And the last time I borrowed it, which was probably only 4 or 5 weeks ago, I said, hey, we should take the tinny out to the dam. And, you know, my young fella's itching to go fishing. He loves it. He's 6 years old. He's just getting into everything that I like, which is great. So I encourage it as much as I can. So I said to Hendo, I said, mate, can we take the boat out? He goes, yeah, no worries. We'll go out for the day. So I went and picked the boat up. And we got, I don't know, 30 meters down the road. And I said, shit, I didn't check the lights. So I stopped, pulled over, checked the lights. No lights working. Had a look at the lights. Everything has perished. Everything. The wires just broke, like brittle, like little bits of hay. And it's like, mate, we can't take this with no lights. You know, move it back. And then he's like, yeah, no worries. I'll get it fixed up. Okay, thanks, bud. So anyway, that was the end of that. And then the next time I borrowed it, he'd rewired the trailer and everything was fine and he'd been over everything. It was all good. So off I went. I took it down the coast and, you know, family holiday. And the first day we're out there, I launched the boat. The family jumped in the boat and everything was cool. And then my son looks down and goes, Dad, is there supposed to be heaps of water in the bottom? I'm like, what? So I look down and there's water up like halfway up my shoe. And I was like, oh, the bung's come out. I said, oh, actually, no, the bung hasn't come out. The shroud that holds the bung into the – that connects to the aluminium had come out. The rivets had rusted off, right? So the bung was still attached, but, you know, it had rusted off. So I was stuffing it full of rags. I'm like, oh, this is not ideal. We're out on a pretty wide it's called Pumice Stone Passage. It's the passage between Bribie Island and Brisbane, right? So it's not open water. It's tidal water basically, but it flows pretty well out to sea. Anyway, we got back in. That was the first time I'd really taken the boat out in ages, and I thought, oh, that's a bit of a sign. I rang Hendo. I said, "Your shitty boat, bloody hell! Like I nearly drowned my family." I sensationalized a little bit, but anyway, he says, "Oh, just under the lid, there'll be some Sikaflex. Just put it back in. Should be right." thought, oh, okay, it's probably a good idea. Sickflick's pretty strong. So I did it. No worries. Well, part of this whole thing was I've never caught a mud crab in my life. In fact, I don't even think I've seen a mud crab. I've never been looking for them. So I bought crab pots. I thought, oh, you know, Xavier and I, we can putt out to the passage and we can put the crab pots in and then we'll come out the next day and it'll be a bit of a dad boy thing. Really cool. He didn't want to come in the boat because he thought it was going to sink. So I went out by myself the next day and I got right out to this area. I was probably 2 Ks away from where I launched the boat and I dropped these crab pots in and I took off. And on my way back, the motor started to cut out. The shit's a bit weird. And then it stopped. This is really weird. And it stopped. And I thought, oh, must be something kinked in the line. Anyway, whatever. I couldn't figure out what it was. So I cranked it and it went again. So sweet. I'm busting it to the boat ramp. And I only made it maybe another 200 meters and smoke come out of the motor. I'm like, oh, shit. I'm now in the middle of the passage. I'm floating out to the ocean. And I'm by myself in a boat with no motor. And anyway. you have that little panic moment. I was like, oh, no, well, everything's all right. I've got phone service. I could ring someone. Anyway, there's these kayakers way the hell over there. I don't know why the hell they were where they were, but I'm waving. And they're like, hey, how you going? Like, they're waving back at me. Didn't realize I was in trouble. And then eventually they went, oh, I think this guy might need a hand. So they came over, and I said, oh, this is the problem. And 2 Ks from the boat ramp, I've thrown them a rope, and they've started towing me back in. God, good on them. Right. So they're tying me back in and everything's fine. And eventually I get back in. I nearly stand on a stingray and, you know, whatever, you know, stuff happened. Got back there and I'm sitting there going, so it's the first time I've thrown crab pots in. I didn't kill the boat completely. I've got it out. I can give it back. But I got crab pots out there and they got my name on them. And, you know, I know that they give you fines if you leave crab pots out in the ocean and you don't go and collect them. I'm like, what am I going to do about it? Well, I bought my kayak, didn't I? So I chucked the kayak in the next day and it was rainy and it was bloody windy and I'm not the smallest human in the world and, you know, things aren't as stable as they might be if you're a fit, skinny bloke. So I'm paddling. I'm literally 100 meters away from the first pot, but there must have been some really good wind protection from a little island that was there. So as soon as I got past that wind protection, I nearly fell out. The waves started kicking up and it was just splashing everywhere and I could nearly touch the pots. But I had to turn around and move. I had to get out of there because I was going to fall out of my kayak. And eventually I come across this boat, and this boat was in the distance. I thought, oh, if I can get to that boat, I can ask them if they want some crab pots. I don't care if they keep them. I just don't want to leave rubbish in the ocean with my name on it, for starters. So anyway, I'm 3/4 away this boat. I've been paddling mad trying to get to this boat, and they see me coming, and they start their motor, and they leave. I'm like, come on, guys, this is – and they only went about 100 meters. So I've changed my direction. I'm chasing these guys in a boat. And they left. They moved again. They just kept moving away from me. And eventually they realized I was coming for them. And I got up to them. I said, hey, I'm trying to talk to you. Oh, thought this was a bit strange. I said, yeah, I just wanted to know if you wanted some crab pots. I've been out there for 24 hours. They might have some crabs in them. I can't get them on this thing. I'm going to fall out. And they're like, this sounds really dodgy. Like, are you just telling me to go get someone else? Anyway, turns out he was a fisho. He was a fishing officer.
Okay.
He was just on a day off, and he went and got them. And the end of the story was we got some crabs, we got the pots back, got the boat back to our mate, but it was a bit chaotic, and I'm not sure how many times I nearly drowned. And it sort of sums up the story.
Oh, nice. Well, mate, at least you got out there because it sounds like my camping story with the kids for the first go. Just absolute chaos.
Oh, my God.
So, so it's, mate, they happen. But you know what? I always say when things like that happen, they're memories and you're always going to remember them. And it's an experience. It's something different. And, you know, if you go away and everything goes right, you're sometimes not going to remember the fun and what happens. So I have no problem with it. I think it's great when things like that
happen. Oh, very true. Yeah, we talk about it. My son laughs about it. Pretty sure he's doing a stand-up little presentation to his class about dad's antics on the water. So it's lasted a little while.
Oh, mate, sounds good. Listen, mate, I really appreciate your time coming on. You know, I've got to get the other boys on too, so that's going to be there as well. And, mate, love what you guys are doing. Keep doing it. Hunt Camp, I'm really hoping you guys are going to do one to the Pillager. And
well, a lot of noise about that right now, yep.
Hope so. Keep me in the loop because I'm keen to get out that way if you guys are doing it. Mm. Hopefully next year I might have a bit more time, but yeah, I've only got the 2-3 days. I'm going to do a few 2-3 day trips, but I can't get more than that. And I sort of went, well, guys wanting to get up there for 7 to 9 days, I'd rather them get up there with you guys, and I'm sure we'll have the opportunity in the future for me to get up there. So,
oh, and if we come down your way, mate, that'd be just as good as well. We don't call ourselves experts, but we certainly have some experience that we can share. We don't have the same experience in Samba, so we'll bring in resident experts for that. We'll just help create the environment, which is a hell of a good time.
Mate, that's all it's about. So I love what you're doing. So keep it up. Guys, if you haven't, I'm sure you have, but if you haven't, jump over, check out Hunters Campfire Podcast, check out the YouTube, some great stuff there. Ian did a fantastic one breaking down state forest hunting and some good videos talking through. And then your mate that you took out and got the deer, you mentioned his name before, it's eluding me at the moment, but he's Dave, got the big beard.
Big Willie.
Dave, that's the one. Yeah, so keep doing it. Best of luck for the rut. Hope you get a couple. Look forward to seeing some photos, and mate, enjoy hunt camp.
Hey, we might have live uplink with Starlink this year. Should be really interesting.
Ooh, look at you guys. All the tech, mate, hey, going all right. I'll be impressed when you get Elon Musk to hunt camp, all right? So with his little Starlink and doing a prezzo.
That would be fun.
So
I'm not sure we'd get him, but we might try for some other celebrities.
Hey, may as well try. What do you got to lose?
All right, best of luck. Best of luck. It's been awesome, mate. Thank you, Matt. Appreciate it.
No worries. All right, listeners, thanks for tuning in. Bye for now.
If you have a topic, guest, question, or any gear that you want to hear about on the podcast, shoot us an email, australianhuntingandbeyond@gmail.com. Alternatively, find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. All the links are in the show notes. If you haven't already, make sure you give us a review and subscribe to our podcast on whatever platform you're listening on. Thanks for joining us, and we'll catch you next time.